This lecture, entitled The Garden of Eden, What Is It and Where Is It Located, is dedicated to the memory and L'ilui Nishmas of Chana Chaya Bas Mendel Aleha Shalom, a blessed memory. One of the world's great and abiding mysteries relates to the location of Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. According to the plain meaning of the text of the Torah, the garden was located at a specific point on this earth. Adam HaRishon, after being created on earth, was placed there and subsequently sent out. One would expect, therefore, that the garden is still there and it could be located. Yet, as far as we know, there's no physical trace of this garden. Now, even in our most recent past, one could still have explained this by the fact that the world was not yet entirely explored, and therefore the garden was probably located in one of the yet unexplored areas of the earth. Today, it's far more difficult to say that with any confidence. As a general consensus, the world is now has been entirely explored. Satellites take continuous and detailed photographs of the Earth's topography with extraordinary clarity. And yet there doesn't seem to be any trace of Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. Has it just vanished into thin air? Another problem associated with the garden relates to the Torah's description of its location. You notice on the first page of the notes, here we quote really from the Torah's description of the Garden of Eden. This is taking the second chapter of Genesis, Bereshis, beginning with the eighth verse. And the Lord God planted a garden east of Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground made the Lord God every tree to grow that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. This we discussed last lecture. And a river went out from Eden to water the garden, and from there was divided and became four rivers. The name of the first is Pishon. That is the one which flows around the whole land of Havilah. And that we're going to discuss the location of this land of Havilah, where there is gold, and the gold of that land is good. There's bdellium and the onyx stone. And the name of the second river is Gihon. That is the one which flows around the whole land of Cush. And again, we'll discuss where Cush is located. And the name of the third river is the Tigris. That is the one which flows towards the east of Assyria. Assyria is in Iraq. Really northern Iraq by the Tigris River. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. And the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and to keep it. Now, what river is Pishon, the first named river? According to Rashi, it's the Nile. And if you notice on the bottom of the first page, if you notice on verse 11, Pishon says, "This is the Nile, the river of Egypt. And because its waters increase and rise and water the land, it is called Pishon." And as in the summer, it rises and it overflows and irrigates the land. And he quotes a verse that we find the word Posh, and the Pishon refers to increasing. Another interpretation, the river is named Pishon because it makes flax to grow. It is stated in regards to Egypt that evidently it's one of their major crops. Moreover, they that work in comb flax, Egyptians shall be ashamed. So it's called Pishon because of the flax. That's Rashi's explanation. But according to Rav Yitzchak Abravanel, quoting non-Jewish sources, actually the sources from the writings of Josephus, the Pishon is not the Nile, but rather the Ganges. And here we have on page 2. Gentile scholars say that the Pishon is the Ganges River. They say that the Havilah is a district of India, and that the Ganges surrounds the entire country of India, and gold could be found in its sand. They also say this river is divided into 10 rivers and it enters the sea, extremely wide, and its most narrow section is 8 miles wide. They say that, the Gihon, again, remember there's two rivers to begin with, right? Pishon and Gihon. The Gihon is the Great Nile, the largest of all rivers which surrounds the entire lands of Kush, I mean, it's really Ethiopia or Sudan, and Egypt. Now, the Abravanel's definition of the Pishon seems to be similar, if not identical, to the translation of the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel on Chumash, who translates the land of Havila as being India. And here, number three, he says the name of the first is Pishon. This is from the Aramaic translation. That is the one which flows around the whole land of India. He says Hindiki, which seems to be India, where there is gold. So the Targum Yonasan seems to identify it similar to Josephus as being the land, at least, is the land of India. So it would seem, therefore, that the question of where the Pishon is, the Pishon's identification, depend on the location of the land of Havila. If we can identify Havila, we know which river is by this Havila. Now, we know that Havila, besides being the name of a land, is a name of a person. And it would seem to be, there's quite a great likelihood that whatever this place Havila is was named after the person Havila. Who is this person Havila? So here on page 2 on paragraph C, we find that there are actually two Havilas. One is a son of Cush. In other words, this is the sons of Chom. This is one of the sons of Noah. Cush and Egypt, Put and Canaan, and the sons of Cush is Sava v'Chavila. This Chavila is one of the sons. Sapta, Rama, Saptacha. But Chavila is a son of Cush. There's another Chavila who is really a descendant of Shem, a Semite. He is really a son of Yoktan, who was a brother of Peleg, and they were both sons, Peleg and Yoktan, of Aver, the father of the Hebrews, or, Semites. And he is his Ophir and Chavila, notice on number two here. And Yovav, all these were sons of Yoktan. I mean, actually, he had a very large family. So you tend to feel, well, it must be in Arabic lands. And we see there's a certain identification about the descendants of Yishmael on the top of page 3, lived from Havila to Shur. Shur is really seems to be at the entrance of Egypt. Some identify Shur as being the wall which separated Egypt from the desert. They built a wall there. That is before Egypt as you go towards Assyria. In other words, it would seem that this Havila is in that... is a swath of land from Shur to Havila going from west to east and then north all the way up to Assyria. I mean, there's a continuous desert. If you go from Jordan all the way to Iraq, there's just desert land. It would seem to be an identification of Havila in Arabic lands. At least that's what it would seem. So it seems to be unlikely that if this land of Havila, if it's India or it's or it's Egypt, not to be associated with the Arabic Havila, but rather with the Havila, which is from Cush, the son of Cush. Because again, there's two people called Havila, and there's one land called Havila. There's a land called Havila, which seems to be Arabic land. And there's this land of Havila, which is associated with this river called the Pishon. Now, in the Arabic land, there's no great rivers there. It would seem to be that we're dealing now, not with the Arabic Havila, but with the Kushite Chavila. Well, if we understand Kush to be related to Egypt, well, that would be Ethiopia or Sudan. In fact, there was an ancient country called Nubia, which is in the northern part of Sudan. There are two. We deal with the Nile River, and we know the Nile River in Egypt. There's one Nile River, but actually, they came from two rivers that combined. There's the White Nile, which we'll discuss soon, and the Blue Nile. They come together by Khartoum in Sudan, and then they flow as one river all the way up from Sudan to Egypt to the sea. The area from Khartoum until Egypt was known by the Egyptians as Kush. So there could be, you know, this Kush and Chavila, like it makes, there's a certain sense here. But what about the identification regarding with India? And here we have on page 3 in paragraph D, this question is Kush India or Ethiopia? There is the beginning of the Megillus Esther begins with the story of Esther, and Ahasuerus ruled 127 provinces, Mahodu viad Kush. Hodu is translated generally relating to India. The language of the Indian today is Hindi. Where's Kush? So if you notice here on paragraph D, there's the Gemara, this is a Megillah in Yud Aleph Amud Aleph in 11a, quotes an argument between Rab and Shmuel about the location of this Kush. One said the Hodu is one end of the world and Kush at the other, which means like the civilized world, which would tend to be one is India and one is Nubia. You know, one is, and the other said that Hodu and Kush adjoin one another. And that the meaning is that not that they were the two ends, but rather these are two adjacent provinces, and it describes how he ruled it, not where he ruled it. He ruled these 127 provinces as if they would all be adjacent to each other, just like Hodu and Kush were adjacent to each other. So we know Hodu is India, so it seemed to be Kush is also India. In fact, the mountain range that separates Afghanistan from Pakistan is called the Hindu Kush Mountains, which would seem to be their two Kushes. And the question, therefore, is between Ram and Shmuel is, are we dealing with the Indian Kush or are we dealing with the Sudanese or Ethiopian Kush? These are the two Kushes. We find this identification of Kush with India. Here we quote number 2 here on page 3. There is a discussion in the Talmud, in the Gemara in Brachos, Lamed Vav and Beis in 36b, about preserved ginger, which comes from the Bay Hindue. Hindue would seem Hindu, would be India. Rashi says Hindue Kushim. He identifies with Kushim. And there's, we notice here on again the next citation 3, in Isaiah 11:11, they're speaking about the Jews returning from the various lands where they came from, and one of the lands is Kush. And if you notice down here, I have it in bold that he translates Kush, the Yonasan ben Uziel, as India. So we do find such an identification. The original peoples of India seem to have been also of darker skin, known as the Dravidians. They were conquered by the Aryans, like from Iran. That's the historians explain the origin of the caste system in India. Came really from the peoples that were conquered and the conquerors Of course, the conquerors, and they were of lighter skin, took the higher castes. And the conquered took the lowest class. So we see at least that this question about the identification of Pishon, which is based on the identification of Chavila, is really based on really these two, this question, where is this Chavila? Is it the Sudanese Ethiopian Chavila, or is it the Indian Chavila? You know, by the way, there, besides the Ganges, there's possibly another identification, either for the Pishon or the Gihon, and that's the Indus River. As the Ganges flows to the east of the Indus. Indus is also one of the great rivers, which flows by Pakistan. It's really closer to this Hindu Kush mountain range. And it is the site of one of the earliest civilizations of man, the Indus Valley civilization. Now, what about the next two rivers? In other words, we talk about the Pishon and the Gihon and its identification. The next two are the Hidekel and the Pras, which are commonly translated Tigris and Euphrates. It seems that that identification is universally held. There doesn't seem to be any argument about it. The only discussion is in terms of the Euphrates as its relationship to the other rivers. It is called the fourth river. Rashi has it, on top of page 4, that the Euphrates is smaller than the other three rivers, because it's the fourth. Even though it's called the Great River, this is when Moshe Rabbeinu was telling the Jews, Moses, they're about to conquer the land, and the land of Israel goes all the way up north until the Great River, the Euphrates. The greatness is not called in terms of its length or its width, but rather anything close to Eretz Yisrael is great. There is, though, another opinion, as I would quote here on page, on paragraph 3 on page 4, that actually the original river is the Euphrates. The others branched off from it, and this is the original one that didn't branch off. In a certain sense, that gives it its greatness. Okay, now that we've established where these, you know, at least we have some sense of where these rivers are, we have really another problem on our hands. And the problem really was noted by Avraham ibn Ezra, here if you on page 4 in paragraph F. This is quoted in the Ramban. Avraham ibn Ezra disagreed with the opinion that Pishon was the Nile, because its source is the White Mountain, I mean it's deep in Africa. For that reason, the river overflows in the summer. I mean, it comes all the way, you know, from the, based on the rain, you know, overflow of the rains and the, you know, in the winter months, all it makes its way, finally in the summer, all the way to, makes its way all the way to Egypt. And he says, if it's so far away, how could it be close? We were saying that it's one river that branches off, the Tigris and the Euphrates. It's a little too far. So the Ramban maintains this is not a serious objection, for it's well known that many rivers flow from their source for a long distance and subsequently re-enter the ground and flow underground a long way, re-emerge from under some mountain a considerable distance away. So he maintained that perhaps it goes underground until it comes up. But we're dealing not generally with the mountains that we find that do this are done in hundreds of miles perhaps, tens or hundreds of miles. But the Nile and the Ganges are thousands of miles away from the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates. Now the Nile, as we said before, is actually made up of two major rivers, the White Nile and the Blue Nile. And at Khartoum in Sudan, both rivers join together to form the Nile. The Blue Nile flows from Lake Tana in the highlands of Ethiopia, which is not so far from Sudan. The White Nile flows from Lake Victoria in Uganda and Tanzania, and Lake Albert in Uganda and Zaire. And they both actually begin its flow from a remote stream in Burundi. You remember the famous thing with Dr. Livingstone, that he was missing? And Stanley, remember the thing, was looking for him. You know, Dr. Livingstone, I presume. He was looking for the headwaters of the Nile. I would not recommend this. Even today, I wouldn't recommend this. But these sources, I mean, this is deep in Africa. These sources are continents apart and many thousands of miles from the headstreams of the Tigris and the Euphrates, which are located in the mountainous areas of eastern Turkey. The identification with the Ganges also creates problems, as the headstreams of the Ganges, which rise in the Himalayas, are located some 2,000 miles from the headstreams of the Euphrates and Tigris. And even the Tigris and Euphrates don't branch out from a common source, but originate from two separate sources about 100 miles apart. So maybe for 100 miles, you could say it goes underground. This is very far apart. And yet Scripture tells us that all of these rivers, Pishon, Gihon, Chidekel, and Pras, originate from one common stream. So there's another problem. There's A, where is Gan Eden? And B, where is the stream from which it all originates? Now, before I begin the next part of this lecture, I'd like to express my thanks to Rav David Brown, Olav HaShalom, blessed memory, the author of Mysteries of the Creation, and someone I had the privilege of knowing while I was learning in Neir Yisrael in Baltimore. I thank him for having first presented the solution to this very difficult problem. Much of the following is based upon his insights that I'm going to quote. Now, the basis of the solution to the previous mentioned problems is a difficult passage in the Talmud, which in itself, at least on the surface, seems to present even more formidable problem than the other problems. But you used the formidable problem, so the Shefel. On page 5, there's a Gemara in Tainus, Yud Amud Aleph. It's also a Gemara in Psachim Tzadik Daled Amud Aleph. Rabbi Shub ben Levi said, the whole world is watered, I mean the second part is from, by the residue of the Garden of Eden, as it is said, and the river went out from Eden, etc. In other words, that river, in other words, we say that it formed, you know, these rivers, Pishon and Gihon, that's the residue of the original river. So the river was really a very large river. And he said, Tana taught the residue of a core of 30 saw is enough to irrigate a Tarkov. There's enough water, if you are irrigating a core is 30 saw, a 60th will, there's 59 parts of the 60 will be absorbed in the soil. 1/60th will not be absorbed and will be the overflow. So that, in a sense, is what this picture you get of this massive water which irrigates the garden, and its overflow is what comes to earth. And the Gemara continues on, Egypt is 400 parsas square. A parsa is 4 meal. A meal is 2,000 amma. So if an amma would be a foot and a half, for instance. It's a question what an amma is. But an amma, a cubit, is a foot and a half. So therefore, a meal, which is 2,000 ammas, is 3,000 feet. A parsa, which is 4 meal, is 12,000 feet, which is like 2.5 miles. And this is, so Egypt is 400 parsas by 400 parsas. 1,000 miles by 1,000 miles. So it's 400 times 2.5. Now, Egypt is 1/60th, this is of Ethiopia, of Cush. Ethiopia is 1/60th of the world, or the civilized world. The world is 1/60th of the garden. The garden is 1/60th of Eden. Eden is 1/60th of Gehenna, purgatory or hell. Thus, the whole world is like a pot lid in relation to Gehenna. Now, there, the Maral of Prague, and his Bera Golem, wanted to explain at least the idea of the world of 60th of the garden, garden of 60th of Eden, in a more metaphorical, philosophical explanation. We do find, for instance, there's an expression about 60ths, which is not to be taken literally, but the idea of it's just a bare taste. We know something which is not kosher falls into, you know, something which is kosher. If there's 1 to 60, so if there's 60 times heter, and there's some which is allowed, and one part which is forbidden, we normally say, unless we know otherwise, that it's so minute you don't feel the taste. And therefore, if you can't see it and you can't taste it, it's bottled, it's considered insignificant, and you're allowed to eat it. If it's one part to 50, one part iser to 59 heter, you can barely taste it. So if, in that sense, therefore, it's really at the cusp, something which you can taste and not taste. The Gemara says Shabbos is a 60th of Olam Haba. It's a 60th of the world to come. It means not gross, or the mathematically 60th. It means it's a taste. Like we say in the Zemiros Me'ein Olam Haba. It's a little bit of Olam Haba. The Gemara says that sleep is a 60th of death. Again, we're not dealing with the number 60 in mathematical terms. We're just the idea of 60 is it's a little taste. In that sense, the Maral wants to explain at least the relationship of this world to Gan Eden or Gan Eden to Eden. And he says as follows, this is in the Bera Gola Be'er Vov in the sixth section here. It says that this world is 60th of the garden, for there is no doubt that this world is physical, therefore the garden, which is not physical, is on a higher level. Eden, which is even more spiritual than the garden, for Eden is the reward that no eye has seen with the exception of God. This is taken from a Gemara we're going to quote the next paragraph in 34b, is even on a higher level, and therefore the garden is the 60th of Eden. So he's learning 60th in terms metaphorically. However, in the context, it's very difficult. The Maral, in the context of the passage in the Talmud, it seems to be being about really physical thing, not just metaphorical. Right? Egypt is a 60th of Cush, is a 60th. The idea of Eden is a 60th of Gehenna. You can't say that tasting Olam Haba is a little taste of how Geshmak Gehenna is. I mean, it isn't like a taste of Gehenna. We're speaking about physicals, and the idea of the whole world as a pot lid in relationship to Gehenna seems we're dealing with space. So we have this question, therefore, where is all of this located? It's an awfully big place. The garden thing, what are we talking about? Actually, the Talmud alludes, or that doesn't at least address, but alludes to this question here, again, on the bottom of page 5. The garden, its entrance, and this is section 3. There's an interesting Gemara they're all interesting, but specifically for this subject. There's a Gemara in Erevin, Yutesom, at Aleph in 19a. As to the Garden of Eden, Reish Lakish said, if it is in the land of Israel, he wasn't sure where it's located, its gate is Beishon. Beishon is, if you're familiar with Israel, it's south of the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee. Because it seems that Rashi explains the Paris, or it's unusual, it produces unusually sweet fruit. If it is in Arabia, its gate is in Geram. If it's in between the rivers, it's an area. Its gate is in Dumaskanin. in Babylon, Abaya praised the fruit of Aver Yamina, and Rava praised the fruit of Harpanya, indicating that perhaps this was the entrance to the garden. But we're dealing with an entrance which is on earth. There's here we quote here on the top of page 6 in paragraph B, this is the Medrash Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, Perek Chof, chapter 20, and he drove Adam from the Garden of Eden to Mount Moriah, for the entrance to the Garden of Eden is close to Mount Moriah. This is where the Mount Moriah is, where the temple was so associated, so now the part of Jerusalem. For man was taken from there, and to there he was returned, as it is stated, to till the ground from where he was taken. This follows the interpretation which we quoted last week, that Adam was taken, really was created from the place where the Mizbeach, the original altar, was. But evidently Gan Eden is pretty close there to Yisroel, the entrance. We have here in paragraph C about the story of that Noah sent out a dove. And it came back, and one of the times he sent it out, it came back, and lo, in her mouth was an olive leaf plucked off. And Noah knew that the waters were abated from off the earth. There's a question in the Medrash, there's a Medrash Rabbah in chapter 33, where did the dove get the olive leaf? So there's one opinion that even though the flood was a, it seems we're going to discuss in the subsequent lecture, was a worldwide flood, in other words, it covered to the highest mountains. However, where the original rain fell and where it would seem there was volcanic activity and water came from the deep, did not occur in Eretz Yisrael. I mean, Eretz Yisrael got the overflow of everything else, but at least the turmoil, the breaking apart, did not happen in Eretz Yisrael. So it was flooded, but what occurred to it was much more gentle than had occurred in the other areas. So it was inundated with water, but it didn't have all of the catastrophe that happened all over. And this was from this was a leaf which came from Israel. You look at yourself, but one opinion, the bottom opinion, which is for our purposes, this is Rabbi Bavoy said, the gates of the Garden of Eden were opened and it brought it from there. Now there's a dove flew into the garden and got it from the garden, which would indicate that the garden was a physical presence. It opened it up, it went in, got it, and took it out. There's another Gemara here. This is on the bottom of page 6 in paragraph D. This is taken from a Gemara in Bava Metzi in Kuf Yudal on the base. That Rabba Bar Avua met Eliyahu. And they started, you know, speaking and learning, and it came out from the conversation that Rabba Bar Avua was not a book, he was not an expert in the laws of Taharis, of ritual cleaning. And he says, even though he was an expert in other areas, but he says, why wasn't he an expert there? He says, I'm very hard pressed. In other words, he just has to, in terms of making a living, he just has so much on the thing, he couldn't concentrate and become an expert in this area. So he became only an expert in areas which have more practical application. He then led him, then Eliyahu led this Rabba Bar to into the Garden of Eden and said to him, remove thy robe and collect and take away some of these leaves. So he gathered them and carried them off. As he was coming out, he heard a remark, you know, a basco. Whoso consumes his portion of the world to come as Rabba Bar Avua has done. This taking from there, he's really taken from his reward. Therefore he scattered and threw them away. Even so, since he had carried them into his robe, it had absorbed their fragrance, and so he sold it for 12,000 dinarim, which he distributed amongst his sons-in-laws. Evidently, he didn't want to have pleasure himself from it, but evidently, as is common today, he supported his sons-in-laws too in learning. Talmid Chachamim. So here we have what seemed. There's really a physical presence to this Gan Eden. The dove entered it, Rabba Rabu entered it. Evidently it was closed, was the flood, the gates were closed, the flood didn't go into it. It was only after the flood subsided that it opened up that he got this. But it seems to be quite physical. So I'd like now to share with you a Kabbalistic text known as Yalkut Ruveni, which opens a new vista of understanding the essence and location of the garden. But first, I'd like to give a little background to help understand what we're going to, this Kabbalistic passage. On page 7, here we quote, we know the story, we quoted that Adam HaRishon, Adam, had been created and placed in the garden. After he had sinned, which we discussed in the last lecture, he was driven out of the garden. And this is how it's described. And the Lord God sent him from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from where he was taken. So he drove out the man, and he placed cherubim at the east of the Garden of Eden. And a flaming sword which turned every way to guard the way of the tree of life. That is, a man shouldn't enter the garden. So there were two things placed. There was the cherubim, cherubs, and this flaming sword. What are they? So the Targum Yonason, again, on this passage says, and he rushed out Adam from the place where he had dwelt, this is amongst the glory of the divine presence, to beyond the area between the two cherubim. Before he had created the world, he created the Torah and prepared the Garden of Eden for the tzaddikim, so they may eat and enjoy the fruits of the trees because they had served God with the study of Torah, fulfillment of the commandments while they were alive in this world. He prepared Gehenim for the evil. It is compared to a sharpened sword, destroys from both sides. So he learns the flaming sword is actually a metaphor for hell, for Gehenim. He prepared in it flames of fire and coals of fire to punish the evil who rebelled while they were alive against the beneficial teachings of the Torah. This is the Torah which one serves from the fruit, says the fruit of the tree of life. It would seem then therefore the cherubim are associated with Torah. This Torah is the way to get to there, but if you don't have Torah, you have the Gehenim, which bars the way. Divine command prepared in this way so the tree of life, the Torah, be preserved, so that one could walk on the path and brings one to the world to come. So really, according to the metaphor, therefore this flaming sword is by the entrance of Gan Eden. So you have the garden, and right before it is Gehenim. And here we have the Medrash Psikta Rav Kahana, this is Psikta 28, Chof Ches. Why did the Holy One create Gehenim and Gan Eden? In order that each one should protect each other, going into it. What is the distance between them? Rabbi Yechon said a wall separates them. Rabbi Chanina said one handbreadth separates them. And the rabbi said they are flush. But they're really next to each other. With that, I'd like to now go to the Sefer Yalkut Ruveni on Parshas Bereishis. You should know that the lower Garden of Eden was created 2,365 years prior to the lower world which we occupy. I mean, it's not lower world means, you know, the world of the non-spiritual world. Evidently, again, as we're going to see, that this is a physical entity. We see about we're dealing with creation here. Does not mean, as others say, yesh ma'ayin, something from nothing. It means the formation of the earth. Its size is a 60th, and is its size referring to the world size, is a 60th of the Garden of Eden, which we had quoted before. This garden stands at the right, the southeast of the world. This world, in comparison to the garden, is like a newborn child in comparison to its mother. The ground of the lower world is distant from the garden by a handbreadth. The northerly part of the lower world is right by the south of the garden. There is located Gehenim, the abode of the demons and destructive angels. The form of the lower world is like that of a base. Continue on, despite this, It is difficult for both the living and dead to go to the garden because of the terror of the demons of Gehenna, who stand in the northerly part of the world. So therefore, in other words, again, this idea that Gehenna is flush with Gan Eden, you can't get to there. You can't get to Gan Eden. Even a person who is worthy of going to Gan Eden can't get there without passing through Gehenna. As though the wisdom of the Holy One, blessed be He, decreed that tunnels be made from the cave of Machpelah, which lead beyond this lower world right up to the garden, in order that the souls of the righteous should travel through them and not meet up with the demons. Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, knew this secret and made the effort to be buried there. According to tradition, Adam and Chava are also buried in Hebron and Moris HaMachpelah. And there's there because there is a straight tunnel. It's interesting, just as a parallel, in which we're going to touch upon at the end of the lecture, in the near-death experiences, many of them describe as leaving this earth and going to this other world as they're going through a tunnel. It's just interesting, the parallel of the metaphor. So it's clear from all of this that Gan Eden and Gehenna are clearly linked. So if we know the location of one, we can discover the location of the other. Well, where is Gehenna located? Which takes us to the next thing called in the depths of the earth. There is a, this is taken from a, really it's a halachic section of the Talmud, Shabbos Lama Tesom at Aleph in 39a. One is not allowed to cook on Shabbos. Cooking is generally made something from fire. Now, at least according to Torah law, and even according to rabbinic law, if you put something in the sun to cook, like just put a pot in the sun, and it cooked it, it's not a normal way of cooking. It's not forbidden by Torah law, and it seems even rabbinically it's not forbidden because it's so rare, it's hard to cook something directly from the sun. There's a question, though, are you allowed, according to Torah law, not only are you allowed to cook directly from the sun, which is not common, but you're allowed also to cook something which is heated from the sun. I know from, I originally come from Southern California, which used to be part of Mexico. So when they make tortillas, you know, they used to, it gets very hot over there. You know, they can make the corn flour and the thing, and they can make a dough, and you could put it on the, you know, on the heated stone, a flat stone, and you can make something with that. I mean, it's possible. It seems according to Torah law, it's allowed. Rabbinically, is a machlokas. There's an argument between the Rabbonin, which is the halacha, which is not allowed, and Rabbi Yossi, who says it is yes allowed. In the discussion between the Rabbonin says it's forbidden, and Rabbi Yossi says it's permitted, the Gemara quotes a proof that the Rabbonin, the majority, want to support, to buttress their case against Rabbi Yossi. There was an incident with the people of Tiberias that they had made a... they created like a pipe where they heated water, regular drinkable water, through the hot springs of Tiberias. So the water ran through it, and this Gemara understands it was a problem of heating the water on Shabbos. Well, this is not fire that you're heating it, it's natural hot springs. And yet it's forbidden. Well, if that's forbidden from the sun, it should also be forbidden. I mean, that is the halacha. You can't cook anything heated from the sun either. How did Rabbi Yossi reply? And he says, no, this also comes from fire. Because the hot springs are really, they go over volcanic rock. Is it probably even because the waters have passed over the entrance to Gehenna? He understood, must be Gehenna must be here, because the waters are coming out of the ground. I mean, they're heated water because it's subterranean water, which is heated. You know, this is quite, as we're going to explain, it's quite hot below. And it's really heated by the volcanic water. But he understood it, well, that's where Gehenna is. There's fire. I mean, basically, he understood there's fire there. So it seemed to be Gehenna is really a lot closer than you think. It's interesting, there's a discussion relating to Gehenna with the story of Korach. You know, Korach, the earth opened up, and he went in, and it seems he went into Gehenna. There's a discussion, he asked, you know, that God should create, you know, something, and he says, well, Gehenna was already created, God didn't have to create it, and the question was creating or moving an entrance, a hole, to get to Gehenna. The sons of Korach on top of page 9, it says, did not die, the sons of Korach did not die. The Gemara says in Megillah 14a, Yudalam Adalav. Atana taught in the name of our teacher, a special place was fenced or fortified for them in Gehenna, and they stood on it. In other words, they all fell down, but there was a special, they didn't go all the way down. There was a special place made for them. But it seems Gehenna is really below. The Vilna Gaon in his Eben Shlema is really a collection of from the writings of the Vilna Gaon, and his is in this last chapter, chapter 10, section 32. They quote: soon after death, the evil person is handed to Duma, who is the angel appointed over the dead while they're in the grave. After 3 days, Duma hands him over to Gehenna, which is in the depths of the earth, in order to refine and purify him. There the evil spirits subjugate him, and everyone taking from him, in other words, basically is that when a person does something which is wrong, it creates a negative force in them. This negative force has to go back to its source. That's what Gehenna is. It removes it, and it goes back to its source. It says, take until his debt is paid. So we have the sense it's really below. It's a lot closer. We quote here on page 9 in paragraph D from Eo, from Job. It's a work is for the earth, from it comes bread, and under it it is turned up as by fire. Its stones are the place of sapphires, as dust of gold. And the Targum to Eov says, underneath the land from which issues forth food is Gehenna. It also says, and the Garden of Eden, because they are next to each other. Here we quote over here that again Gehenna, again the Medrash Rabbah, Bereishis is below the deep of the sea, and describing it, the evil is an embodiment of darkness, and Gehenna is darkness, and the deep is a place of darkness. It says, I transported the evil to Gehenna and cover them with the deep. Darkness covers darkness. So it would seem, therefore, saying that Gehenna is really within the earth. Gan Eden, it would seem, is next. It was also below the earth. And we hear a quote on page 10 from the Vilna Gaon. The lower Garden of Eden, because they speak of a higher Garden of Eden, really is a true spiritual world. But the lower Garden of Eden is in the deep interior. This is Lefnai v'Lefnim. It's the highest, means spiritual levels. The seven lands are referred to as Tevel, the populated area of the earth. It is the loftiest spiritually of them. But physically, it would seem to be below. With this in mind, you know, we can understand the fact that Gehenna is so large, you know, 60 times that of Eden. Eden is 60 times the garden 60 times the earth, because if we're dealing with two-dimensional space, but with three-dimensional space, the living area of the earth is really not two. If we take the whole earth and just put the thing, how high are we? 6 feet high. So how high is the living space above the surface of the earth at any one place? That's where we live. We live in an area which is across the globe, but only some 6, 7, 8 feet tall. Depends how, you know, I don't know if any of the basketball players are 8 feet tall. But, you know, but this is, that's how, this, that is the area that we occupy. Below, we have now three-dimensionally, it's much bigger. And in that sense, we can understand where Gan Eden is so much bigger, or Gehenna is so much bigger, because now we're dealing with three dimensions and not just two dimensions. You know, it's been compared. It says that if we compare the inside of the earth to its surface, is like comparing the skin of an apple to the fruit. I mean, it's a nothing. Now, it's quite possible that some of the garden was originally above the earth, and it's not clear where Adam was, and it's sunk to below the earth, only its entrance remaining on earth. But it would seem that though that Aden, which is much larger an entity, was never on earth. And we had quoted before that the idea that Aden is the area of the reward of Olam Haba, which no eye has seen except you, God, because it is below the earth and it has never been seen by anyone. And then, of course, as we said, Gehenna is much larger, which is adjacent, right, to the subterranean Garden of Eden, which is below the earth. But one wonders, but how is the garden lit up? How can vegetation thrive in a lightless and sunk environment? And which takes us, I believe the answer is, here this is in paragraph G on page 10. This is in Shmos Rabbah. This is in chapter 18. And it's dealing with the fact, according to the Medrash, that the night of Passover, when they left Egypt, it was a lit. It was like a day. So the Medrash says, in this world a miracle occurred to them, the Jewish people, the time they left Egypt. At night, there became light, but it was a temporary miracle. In the future, the night will turn into day, as it is stated. Moreover, the light of the moon shall be the light of the sun, and the light of the sun shall be multiplied, shivosayim, a multiple of 7, as the light of the 7 days. But it would seem to be that the moon, which will still be at night, according to this, will be lit up. It will be like the light which the Holy One, blessed be, originally created and hid in the Garden of Eden. So as clearly is, there was an original light, it was hidden. Where is it? It's in the garden. So it's lit up. It has its own light source, according to this. Regarding now, let's assume this is so. Regarding the question about the location of the rivers, so we're really the original river that irrigated. This is deep below the earth. It's not on the surface. It's deep below the earth. And subsequently, from there, it branched off. Well, branching off there, it has to go anyway up. So it's the difference. It goes up straight or goes up at an angle, so it could go up and go up thousands of miles, one apart from the other. The significance of these particular countries where they come from is going to be discussed in the next lecture. But at least the difficulty of how do you have one thing stretching out, it's really below the earth. And really it's coming up. It's coming up every hundreds of miles up. It's coming up, so this isn't coming straight up, it comes at an angle. That's why it could go up, you know, so many miles. Where it's origin, then it comes up to the earth, and really therefore that which is irrigating these areas, the origin of the Nile, the Ganges, would not be just a runoff or the deep, you know, river of the springs created by the absorption of the melted snow or rain, but rather from the subterranean source. Now, we spoke about the garden, about the Maral describes it as more spiritual than on earth. What is its function today? And here you could look at the, I quote here from the Ramban on page 10, but I'd like to quote here on paragraph C of on page 11. Here, the Ramban before speaks that there's a physical Gan Eden, and there's a corresponding higher Gan Eden, a spiritual world. But what about the physical Gan Eden? And here we quote now from the Drushas Haran. This is Drush Zion, the seventh Drusha of the Rabbeinu Nisim. It is clear, well attested fact that even though the spirit is not actually physical, and we discussed about spirit in the last lecture, since it dwelled in a physical body, it thinks in physical terms, and therefore after it leaves the body, it must still dwell in a physical location. As a result, the Garden of Eden is in the lower physical world, for it would be too difficult for the spirit to immediately make the transition to a spiritual world without taking intermediate steps. Since it originally dwelled in the lower world, the spirit is transferred to a location which is intermediate between the physical and the spiritual. This is the advantage the garden has over other places. This is from the Ram. So about its fact. Now, in this last section here of the notes, I'd like to shed further light on location, size, and heat of Gehenna. We've quoted before from various sources which indicate the Gehenna is really is below the earth. As the Gemara describes it in Brachos 57b, that fire here is a 1/60th of the fire of Gehenna. Again, the 1/60th in terms of metaphorically, like Shabbos is a 60th of Olam Haba. But below the earth, it is quite hot. It's interesting, though, that in the according to earth scientists, the inner core of the earth is about 4,500 degrees centigrade, or 8,130 degrees Fahrenheit. So Gan says, it's quite hot. On the average, temperature increases from the earth's surface downward at a rate of about 3 degrees centigrade, or 5 degrees Fahrenheit per 100 meters, or 330 feet of depth. But this increase is not constant, but basically there's a tendency, the lower you go, the hotter it gets. But the heat below is dynamic, churning through convection currents of molten rock up through the surface, heating hot springs such as the waters of Tiberias, and being reabsorbed into the interior. Scientists conjecture that the source of the heat of the Earth's interior is the energy released from the breakdown of radioactive elements. The fact that the Gehenna is part of the Earth's interior may add another dimension as to the heat source of the Earth's interior. Here we describe, which is a fascinating thing, on page 12, paragraph B. There are 8,000 gates to Gehenna, and each section of Gehenna is 300 long, 300 wide, 1,000 thick, and 100 deep. Any wicked pig who falls there cannot arise on his own. Now, as Rav David Brown explained in his Mysteries of Creation, generally we think of three dimensions, Here we have four, right? Three long, 300 long, 300 wide, 300, 1,000 thick, and 100 deep. What's this fourth dimension? So he explains it very, very interestingly. The earth is a sphere. If we're going with something below the earth, right? The sphere, if we make a sphere or something below the earth, it's going to be a smaller sphere, right? It keeps on growing. Well, at the height of Gehenna, we have an area which is 300 by 300 long. But as it's going to the surface, it narrows. So it's a thousand going from the surface to below, but at the bottom now, it's 100 by 100. Start off as 300 by 300, but it goes down, and it to 100 by 100. That's how he explains this Medrash Yalkut Shemoneh, this in Yeshaya. He also, as you can look at the notes, the Gehenna seems all to be expanding. There's just an awful lot of room there. More people makes plenty of space. The more averus a person does, the more sins, more space is created. So don't worry. Plenty of room. In conclusion, I'd like to read for you from a work entitled A Death's Door by Dr. Maurice Rawlings. It starts from page 17. The book deals with the near-death experience. There's people who nearly died or were declared dead, but yet came back to tell a remarkable similar story. You know, about how their consciousness left their body. They observed their body, you know, basically lying, like hovering from a point above the body. Many describe entering a spiritual world. These stories, and this particular story, has amazing affinities to our present subject on many different levels. Now, the following, this is from his book, is a description of what happened to a patient of his who was in the midst of taking a stress test on a treadmill while being connected to an EKG, an electrocardiogram machine. And I'm quoting now from the book, starting from page 17. This patient was 48-year-old white male who was a rural mail carrier. He was of medium build, dark-haired, and had a personality that would please anyone. Unfortunately, he represented one of those rare instances where the EKG not only went, quote-unquote, haywire, but the heart stopped altogether. He had a cardiac arrest and dropped dead right in my office. Instead of fibrillating, he was twitching without a beat, the heart had just plain stopped. He crumbled to the floor, lifeless. With my ear to his chest, I could hear no heartbeat at all. With my hand alongside his Adam's apple, I could feel no pulse. He gave one or two sighing breaths before he quit breathing altogether. There were scattered muscle twitchings and then convulsions. He was gradually turning blue. Although six other doctors work as partners in the same clinic, it was late afternoon and they had gone on to other hospitals to make evening rounds. Only the nurses were left, but they knew what to do, and their performance was commendable. While I started external heart massage by pushing in on his chest, one nurse initiated mouth-to-mouth breathing. Another nurse found a breathing mask, which made it easier to expand his lungs for him. Still another nurse brought the emergency cart containing pacemaker equipment. Unfortunately, the heart would not maintain its own beat. A complete heart block had occurred. The pacemaker was needed to overcome the block and increase the heart rate from 35 beats per minute to 80 or 100 per minute. I had to insert a pacemaker wire into the large vein beneath the collarbone, which leads directly to the heart. One end of this electric wire was manipulated through the venous system and left dangling inside the heart. The other end was attached to a small battery-powered gadget that regulates the heartbeat and overcomes the heart block. The patient began, quote-unquote, coming to. But whenever I would reach for instruments or otherwise interrupt my compression of his chest, the patient would lose again consciousness, roll his eyes upwards, arch his back in mild convulsion, stop breathing, and die once more. Each time he regained heartbeat and respiration, the patient screamed, "I'm in hell!" He was terrified and pleaded with me to help him. I was scared to death. In fact, this episode literally scared the hell out of me. It terrified me enough to write this book. He then issued a very strange plea. "Don't stop!" You see, the first thing most patients I resuscitate tell me as soon as they recover consciousness is, quote, "Take your hands off my chest, you're hurting me," unquote. I'm big, and my method of external heart massage sometimes fractures ribs. But this patient was telling me, quote, "Don't stop!" Then I noticed a genuinely alarmed look on his face. He had a terrified look, worse than the expression seen in death. This patient had a grotesque grimace expressing sheer horror. His pupils were dilated, he was perspiring, trembling, he looked as if his hair was, quote unquote, on end. And so another strange thing happened. He said, "Don't you understand, man, I'm in hell. Each time you quit, I go back to hell. Don't let me go back to hell." Being accustomed to patients under this kind of emotional stress, I dismissed his complaint and told him to keep his hell to himself. I remember telling him, quote, "I'm busy, don't bother me about your hell until I finish getting this pacemaker into place," end quote. But the man was serious, and it finally occurred to me that he was indeed in trouble. He was in a panic like never seen before. As a result, I started working feverishly and rapidly. By this time, the patient experienced 3 or 4 episodes of complete unconsciousness and clinical death from cessation of both heartbeat and breathing. After several death episodes, he finally asked me, "How do I stay out of hell?" I told him I guess it was the same principle learned in Sunday school, that I guess God would be the one who would ask to save you. Then he said, "I don't know how. Pray for me." Pray for him? What nerve? I told him I was a doctor, not a preacher. "Pray for me," he repeated. I knew I had no choice. It was a dying man's request. So I had him repeat the words after me. He worked right there on the floor. It was a very simple prayer because I did not know much about praying. It went something like this. "Lord, I ask you to keep me out of hell. Forgive my sins. I turn my life over to you. If I die, I want to go to heaven. If I live, I'll be on, quote, on the hook forever." The patient's condition finally stabilized, and he was transported to a hospital. I went home, dusted off the Bible, and started reading it. I had to find exactly what hell was supposed to be like. I had always dealt with death as a routine occurrence in my medical practice, regarding it as extinction with no need for remorse or apprehension. Now I was convinced there was something about this life after death business after all. All of my concepts needed revision. I needed to find out more. It was like finding another piece in the puzzle that supports the truth of the scriptures. I was discovering that the Bible was not merely a history book. Every word was turning out to be true. I decided I'd better start reading it very closely. A couple of days later, I approached my patient with pad and pencil in hand for an interview. At his bedside, I asked him to recall what he actually saw in hell. Were there any flames? Did the devil have a pitchfork? What did hell look like? He said, quote, "What hell? I don't recall any hell," end quote. I recounted all the details he had described 2 days earlier while he was on the floor next to the treadmill machine being resuscitated. He could recall none of the unpleasant events. Apparently, the experiences were so frightening, so horrible, so painful, that his conscious mind could not cope with them. They were subsequently suppressed far into his subconscious. The man, by the way, has, quote-unquote, stayed on the hook. He does, however, remember the prayer we said. He remembers passing out once or twice after that. He still does not recall the experience that occurred in hell, but he does recall standing in the back of the room and watching us work on his body there on the floor, which is very common. He also recalls meeting both his mother and stepmother during one of these subsequent death episodes. The meeting place was a gorge full of beautiful colors, also other relatives who had died before. This experience was very pleasurable, occurring in a narrow valley with very lush vegetation and brilliant illumination by a huge beam of light. He, quote-unquote, saw his mother for the first time. She had died at age 21 when he was 15 months old, and his father had soon remarried. This man had never seen a picture of his real mother, and yet he was able to pick her picture out of several others. A few weeks later, when his mother's sister, after hearing of his experience, produced some family pictures for identification. There was no mistake, the same auburn hair, the same eyes and mouth. The face was identical to the lady he saw in his experience. She was still 21 years old. There was no doubt it was his mother. He was astounded, and so was his father. End quote. This is a quote from Dr. Rawlings' book. The description of heaven is very much like other near-death experiences and appears to be somewhat a midpoint between a spiritual and physical entity, like we quoted before in the Drushas Haran. Let me first quote you from Dr. Moody's book, Reflections on Life After Life, which he published in 1975, just as the comparison of the experience of this patient, Dr. Rawlings, and this other patient. This begins on the bottom of page 16 of that book. Quote, I was at the head of the bed looking at them, as people were working on them, and looking at them and my body. And one time, one nurse reached up to the wall over to the bed to get the oxygen mask that was there. And as she did, she reached through my neck. You can imagine the picture. After I floated up, I went through this dark tunnel. Notice the tunnel. And came out into a brilliant light. And again, in the parallel of the light, we quoted the Medrash, that the light, the original light, is in Gan Eden. And further on, a little bit later on, I was there with my grandparents and my father and my brother who had died. Again, this is very common. There's a Zohar in Parshas Noso that describes this as well. There was the most beautiful, brilliant light all around, and this was a beautiful place. There were colors, bright colors, not like here on earth, but just indescribable. There were people there, happy people. People were around, some of them gathered in groups, some of them were learning. Off in the distance I could see a city. There were buildings, separate buildings. They were gleaming bright. People were happy in there. There was sparkling water, fountains. City of light, I guess, would be the way to say it. It was wonderful. There was beautiful music. Everything was just glowing, wonderful. But if I had entered into this, I think I would never have returned. I was told that if I went there, I couldn't go back. That decision was mine, end quote. What's truly amazing is the similarity of these visions, you know, in the many studies. Here in Dr. Rawlings' account, we have visions of both Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, and Gehenim, areas which seem to have experienced in tandem, which lends credence to the idea that they're adjacent, and the idea that you have to go through one to the other. In other words, his fear, his fright, was he was going through Gehenim in order to get to Gan Eden. In summary, we ask the question, where is the Garden of Eden? We answered that it's actually located beneath the earth, as is Gehenim, hell or purgatory. Its present function, as we quoted from the Drush HaSaran, is to grant a semi-spiritual experience for departed souls, those who merit it. I guess those who are highly elevated go from there to much higher levels. And in conclusion, we quoted from two near-death experience studies, which seems to bear out at least some of this. Okay, thank you. Now, are there any questions?
You have, different times you talked about the elements that there were four elements, and today we look at it differently. When you have enough focus in where he was saying the Kaliyah Kavariya, and that's the head, because it was hot water, and maybe that's why. Is that because they didn't know geology, or is that because they had a different way of learning it?
No, well, your question about how we would understand Rabbi Yossi's statement that the water goes over the entrance to Gehenna. How we're understanding it now, if Gehenna is beneath the earth, and it really is the molten area, it's quite possible that it is true, that it went over the entrance to Gehenna. The Rabbanan disagree, you know, but it's quite, you know, it's quite likely that's what's happening. It really is went over.
Seismic equipment that is available today, while they haven't dug down so far.
Yeah, they really, I think the deepest they've gone down is 3 miles. You know, to the center of the earth is 4,000 miles. So it's, you know, it's not too much. Basically, our knowledge of we have very little knowledge. All is really circumstantial evidence, you know, of what's below. It's really akin to Plato, his books, and you know, the section is called his Phaedon, which describes, this is from Socrates describing before his death and describing what happens after death. And describes about our understanding of reality. And he says it's a classic moshel that he gives, a classic analogy. He says, imagine, if you would, you have prisoners in a cave. There on the cave has really, there are two In this cave, there are two stories. So they are on the bottom story, and there's a story above them. There is action that's happening above them. They could hear it, but they don't know what's happening. There evidently is a fire, which is on the second story of this cave. They don't see the actual fire, but what they do see is shadows of the people or the things on the top story as they're projected by the fire, and the shadows on the wall. So all they see is shadows. Shadows come, shadows go. And the prisoners below only speculate what's really above on the second story based on the shadows. And what Socrates, according to this thing, was saying is all we see in this life are just shadows. We don't know what really occurs. We just have hints. Eventually, a person goes to the other world. He's talking about the other world. Then you see what it really is. Akin to that, our knowledge of the interior of the earth is probably less than the shadows of Phaedon of Socrates' Marshall. We know very, very little. That's the truth. It's largely based on speculation. So it's hard to say that we know anything. But according to these sources, at least what we see is that really there is something below the earth. Yeah.
There seems to be like two things. There's a garden and there's Eden.
Right.
What exactly?
Yeah, the question was about the garden and Eden. This garden, is a garden. And if we assume, which is quite likely, that the people at the near-death experience came to this garden, it's this semi-physical, semi-spiritual world, which the spirits, and we explained in the previous lecture that the spirit, the ruach, really has some sort of a spirit body. You know, as we explained, it's not, there's a definite part which has hands, you know, you would call it an energy field, whatever it was. There's something which is akin, partial, and that goes to this place. That's Gan Eden. That's the Garden of Eden. Eden itself was what we've never seen. Ayin lo yarasa zulasecha Elokim. Only you, God, have seen this. But it is supposed to be much more of a spiritual entity. And that is the, according to one opinion, that is awaiting the tzaddikim at the end of the days.
So Gan Eden
is the Garden of Eden.
It's a lower level than Eden itself?
Whatever it is, you know, wherever it's associated, it would not have the heat of Gan, or whatever it is, that heat would be dissipated, whatever it would. It wouldn't have, I mean, below the earth, it's hot. You know, it's not, but it is an area below the earth, that's what it seems.
The Gan Eden.
And Eden is also seems to be there. Because it went to say there's a 60th, and Gehenna is a, you know, 60 times. It would seem in that context we're dealing with physical.
But the Gan Eden then is a lesser level
than the Eden itself. Spiritually, it's a much smaller thing, like the Maral says. Stay tuned. Okay, a good tavach.